man. He is charged with the murder of a lady, charged with causing the death of an infant by shaking him.
In 1997, the murder trial of British au pair Louise Woodward captivated audiences around the world.
An English nanny, you know, Mary Poppins, was on trial.
Gasping for breath.
Woodward was accused of a form of child abuse called shaken baby syndrome.
He told us a baby stands breathing.
8-month-old Matthew Eaton was with his au pair Louise Woodward when he was rushed to the hospital, where authorities very quickly suspected child abuse.
We knew that the injuries this child had suffered, given that he was fine that morning and the time he was in the emergency room, he was on death's door, those had been inflicted injuries. They were severe, they were acute, and they were not accidental. And the real issue was who could have done this to him.
They focused on the nanny, 18-year-old Woodward, and when Matthew died, charged her with murder. 7 months later, the nanny murder trial was covered gavel to gavel on Court TV. It dominated the headlines and sparked a nationwide debate on child care and working parents.
I wouldn't put my children in the hands of an au pair, and I do question the decision of the doctors Eapen.
Much of the public's criticism was unfairly aimed at the baby's mother, Deborah Eapen.
Not only had she lost her child, now she felt she was on trial.
Deborah Eapen has suffered a barrage of hate mail blaming her for causing the tragedy by working and leaving her kids in the care of a teenager.
But while the media focused on the dangers of daycare, the trial became a case study for this little-known condition called shaken baby syndrome.
Most people, I would warrant, before this trial had never heard of shaken baby.
After I looked at Matthew's imaging, I did in fact think that this had to be shaken baby syndrome plus some impact to cause the fracture to the skull and the fracture to his arm.
When Matthew was irritable, she got really angry at him because she didn't want to deal with it. And she shook him and, we believed, cracked his head.
Woodward consistently denied hurting the baby. Her defense team, paid for by the au pair agency, brought in experts who suggested alternate explanations for the baby's injuries.
We had the best scientists available. We could bring them in. We could get them to analyze the evidence as quickly as possible.
They argue that the skull fracture may have been at least 3 weeks old when Matthew died, and that without witnesses, there was no way to prove what happened beyond a reasonable doubt.
On cross-examination by Mr. Scheck, any question he asked that might even suggest a mechanism other than abuse, I was rejecting. I was adamant that it had to be child abuse, shaken baby syndrome with impact, could be nothing else.
Her hyperacute shaken impact head injury.
After 3 days of deliberation, the jurors came back with their verdict.
Welcome back to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Good evening.
And today's episode is Shaken Baby, the murder of Matthew Eapen. So this case is from back in 1997, and it was really big news at the time. An 18-year-old British au pair was accused of killing an 8-month-old baby boy who was in her care. Now, the baby boy, Matthew Eapen, was the younger of the two sons of Deborah and Sunil Eapen. Now, Sunil was the son of Indian immigrants, and Deborah was a pretty blonde, all-American girl. Louise Woodward was the family's third au pair. Now, the trial of Louise Woodward was played on Court TV. The prosecution presented 8 physicians involved in Matthew's care who testified that his injuries had occurred as the result of violent shaking and from his head being hit against a hard surface. The architect of Louise Woodward's defense was none other than Barry Scheck, one of O.J. Simpson's defense team members and a co-founder of the Innocence Project. So Scheck was hired and paid for by Louise's employer. As Louise was on trial in court, the Eapens were on trial by public opinion. Deborah Eapen was accused of excessive coldness in her public appearances. Her decision to continue her career after having children was questioned. When the couple was quiet, they didn't care about their baby. Now, when they spoke out, they were more concerned with milking their 15 minutes of fame than grieving for their child in a properly discreet manner.
A can't-win situation, huh?
Right. And the public was torn on its views of Louise Woodward. She was an innocent and overwhelmed girl to some, and a child-killer party girl to others. So we'll discuss the lives of the Eppen family, the life of Louise Woodward, and how these lives intersected and met with the tragic death of Mattie Eppen. There's also a good deal of controversy in the science of shaken baby syndrome that Dick's going to help us out with tonight. Right, Dick?
I'm ready to.
Okay.
Although, to me, there's no controversy, but we'll talk about that later.
We'll get to that, sure. But first things first, I'm going to read a 5-star review, and then Dick's going to introduce the beer.
Got it.
Okay, so, 5-star review. Accidental Favorite by Riddle Me Sphinx. As a true crime addict, I've been making my way through all the podcasts in this genre that iTunes has to offer. Stumbled across TCB, and now Jill and Dick are like my long-lost friends I never knew. I never knew I had. I love their banter and their dedication to telling a thoroughly researched and unbiased, well, they try, story. The production quality has dramatically improved since the beginning, episodes 2. I drive a lot for work and otherwise work from home, so I've been binging TCB like crazy. So I'm sad to have to start waiting for a new episode every week. I really hope you'll cover a case from Ohio soon. You haven't done one yet. I think Dick would really enjoy the Rheingeist Brewery out of Cincinnati or the IPAs out of Warped Wing in Dayton. Thank you both for everything you do. From Riddle Me Sphinx.
Sphinx.
So Riddle Me Sphinx, welcome to the brewery, and thank you for your review.
That's a nice review. I've had some Rheingeist beers, and so I would look forward to doing an Ohio crime and to be able to review one of them.
All right. Well, I'll look for one.
All right.
Let's hear about the beer that you're reviewing tonight.
The beer I'm reviewing tonight is from a newer brewery in Massachusetts that's really hitting a bunch of home runs. It's called Trillium Brewing Company. They're based in Canton and in Boston in Massachusetts.
Sure.
Right. So, and the beer I decided to review was Fort Point Pale Ale, which is probably their flagship beer, although it's tough to choose. They make such wonderful IPAs that it's hard to choose one over the other. Fort Point Pale Ale, however, is an American Pale Ale, which generally means there's a good balance between malt and hops. It's not terribly hoppy. They tend to be fruity and not too bitter. So Fort Point is a hazy orange gold color, nice white head with plenty of lacing on the sides of the glass. It's got a very good fruity aroma, taste of both orange, grapefruit, and, whoa, wait, little melon sneaks in there.
Wow, that sounds a little, I don't know about that.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Melon, really?
Yes. Okay. And there's just a slight bitterness. So this is a light to medium bodied beer. One that you can drink and have a good time with.
Okay, let's open it up.
Open this baby up.
So, let's go down to the quiet end of the bar to talk about shaken baby syndrome and the Matthew Eppen case.
Okay, and this is a little bit of a tough topic to cover. So yeah. I hope there's no drunk, sloppy people down there.
No, it looks pretty empty, actually.
Good.
There are some people at the tables, but the bar is bare.
I'm not feeling very companionable.
No?
No.
Okay. All right, that's okay. You'll get through it.
I'm sure I will.
Okay, so the case tonight. Let's start with a little bit about Deborah and Sunil, okay?
It's a good place
Matthew's
to start,
parents.
Right?
Yep. So Deborah and Sunil Eppen, they actually met and fell in love in college, and that was in Chicago. And they were at a Christmas party, so it was about this time of year. Both medical students, they had a common ambition, and they were a couple for 7 years before they married.
So there was some commitment there.
Yeah, when asked about it, they said they wanted to be financially independent before they started a family. There were also some issues between the two families because Sunil had a traditional Indian family that wasn't super thrilled about the relationship in the beginning.
Probably not.
Although they did warm up to Deborah.
Maybe they were going to try an arranged marriage.
Yeah, that's what they were thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, after graduation, they moved to Boston when Sunil began his residency at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Deborah began to establish herself in the field of ophthalmology. They had a son named Brendan, and 2 years later, their second child, Matthew, was born. So after these many years of study, having accumulated some large student loan debt, Deborah didn't want to abandon her career. They considered their child care options and decided on an au pair service. And after having positive experiences with their first two au pairs, the Epins hired Louise Woodward. She was an 18-year-old from England. Now, by all accounts, Louise grew up in a stable and a loving home. Her father was a carpenter, and her mother worked at a local college. Louise and her younger sister, Victoria, were only a year apart in age. They had a large extended family as well. And Louise regularly attended church, and she helped with the children in Sunday school. On weekends, she worked in a record store. So, following her A-levels at the local Helsby High School, Louise decided to take a year off before committing to college. Relatives said that Louise really loved kids and was fascinated by the United States, so she applied with an au pair agency that was working out of Massachusetts. So by late summer in 1996, Louise was working for the Comashain family in Manchester-by-the-Sea.
That's a wealthy suburb of Boston.
Okay. But it was 30 miles north of Boston.
Right.
So a little bit farther from the city. Because,
well, that's true.
Yeah.
But, see, this is one of the first points that makes me think that Louise had more on her mind than simply caring for children.
Well, I would argue that all 18-year-olds do, to a certain point.
Well, yeah, but yeah. You've signed up as an au pair, and your first consideration is for the family that you're working for.
It should be, yeah.
But she felt that Boston was too far away for her nightlife.
That's what I've heard, yeah. That seems to be the consensus. But in that household, she was caring for an 8-month-old baby. But things weren't what she expected. Her employers, Harris and Lauren Comashain, lived in kind of a secluded area, and it was far from the city. They also gave Louise an 11 p.m. curfew on weekdays, which left her only the weekends to visit Boston.
And I would submit, here I am, I'm a crotchety old man tonight.
Yeah, you are.
So an 11 o'clock curfew on weeknights seems to me entirely reasonable. And on weekends, you can bust out and have a good time.
I really do agree with you, yes. I think that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think she needs to be out past 11 during the week. You know, why? She's going to be tired in the morning. She might have trouble getting up, helping out. So I totally agree with you, yeah.
Okay.
Maybe I'm a bit crotchety as well.
Yeah, you're not old.
So, Louise was eager to meet more young Americans in the city of Boston. So she asked the agency, and they gave her information on other families in the area. And in November of 1996, she met Sunil and Deborah Epin for lunch. Now, they hit it off right away. Deborah noted, actually, that Woodward went straight over and picked up the 6-month-old baby Matthew. So they went ahead and hired her. But after all, Louise found the work at the Epins tough going. In addition to looking after their toddler, Brendan, she was also in charge of Matthew during the day. And sometimes they'd ask her to clean up and cook the meal, and it's really not what she had signed up for. I think she thought this was going to be more of a fun adventure than actual work.
Yeah. And again, wouldn't you think that you would go over the terms of the agreement and find out exactly what's expected of you?
Well, I think they did. I think part of it was that they agreed not to give her the curfew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the part about maybe preparing meals sometimes, caring for two kids, I mean, this is all kind of understood before you're hired.
Yes. I think it was probably talked about, yeah. But, you know, saying something and actually doing it are two different things to actually live it.
Right.
Right?
Oh, absolutely. So apparently the Epins had been eager to hire Louise because she seemed like such a good kid. And they had agreed not to impose a curfew on weeknights. which was good for Louise because they lived in a suburb of Boston that was very, very accessible.
Yeah, Newton.
To Boston.
Yeah.
So she could come in and out. In her spare time, Louise went out frequently, meeting new people, eating out, and sometimes going to bars using a fake ID. She's a theater lover, and she went to see the musical Rent at least 20 times with her friend and fellow au pair, Ruhana Austin, also known as Rue. How the hell can you watch Rent 20 times?
I don't know. I never saw Rent.
Oh, well, okay.
It's a musical, though, and if you like a musical, I bet I watched Chicago 20 times, and I loved it every time.
Rent wasn't that good.
Okay. Well, I don't know.
Who knows? She's 18.
Well, yeah. We can let that go.
So eventually, Deborah had to complain to Louise on several occasions that she was neglecting her duties, in particular for leaving the children unsupervised. Now, that's a little bit of a different thing here. I mean, on the one hand, they don't impose a curfew. They're expecting Louise to self-curfew herself?
Well,
that didn't come out right, did it?
They're expecting her to manage her life so that she's available and can get her work done.
So they had some difficulties with her. So when did they hire her?
I think it was November.
So by the end of January in 97, Deborah Epen laid down new guidelines, which read in part, "We expect you to be honest in your dealings with us and that your primary goal while working is the safety and well-being of our children."
That sounds reasonable.
It does, but I mean, that sounds like total 180.
What do you mean?
I mean, first they're not giving her any curfew and stuff, and they've had some discussions with her, and then they're saying, well, it sounds like you're not taking care of our kids.
Well, I think that they expected her to manage things appropriately, and she wasn't doing that. So they decided to have this meeting and kind of lay down some stricter guidelines for her.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just wondering from what we've read, what was going on to make Deborah so concerned? Is there something more to the story?
Well, some of the things I heard is that in the mornings when the couple was trying to get off to work, and by the way, Deborah only worked 3 days a week, so it wasn't every single day that she
So she
left.
Was like a part-time ophthalmologist.
Well, yeah. I mean, she probably did long days. You know how it is when you're a young doctor.
Yeah. And I'm sure the days she worked a long day.
Sure, yeah. But I'm just thinking in the mornings, they're trying to get ready for work. They probably want someone up early, you know, feeding the kids breakfast, taking care of the kids so they can get ready for work.
Exactly.
And they said they'd have trouble waking her up, which, as a mother, I know it can be hard to get a teenager up in the morning if they've been out partying.
Well,
or even if they haven't.
Even if they haven't. But still, she's hired on to take care of the kids.
Yes.
So it's up to her to be able to get up in the morning and be ready to take care of the kids.
Well, it is, but that's the thing about this program is she's not really hired like a person who's experienced and trained and hired as a nanny.
Right.
It's kind of an exchange of room and board, you know, and they can stay in a different country, and then in exchange they watch the children, which works fine for some people maybe that have a little more discipline. But, you know, Deborah had said to her mother on a couple occasions that she felt like she just had a third kid. Now she had a teenager to take care of.
Yeah.
And I can totally relate to that.
It sounds like that.
Yeah. I mean, even if Louise was a good, fine person, I could see that a teenager could be not the most responsible person rely on for something so serious.
She's just completed high school.
Right.
And she's coming to the States to enjoy life.
Right.
You know? And as luck would have it, she's going to take care of kids. So I'm not sure her primary goal is the care of the kids.
Probably not her primary. Some things that were discussed was she was on the phone a lot with her friend Rue.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the kids weren't getting as much attention as Deborah would have liked.
Yeah. But then, you know, that gets down to communication between the Epens and Louise in terms of here's what we expect from you, and Louise saying here's what I'm willing to do.
Right. But, I don't know, dealing with a teenager, they might say something and then they can't quite live up to it. I don't know.
Well,
I think it was a tough spot.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah. But, you know, we have a couple friends that have used au pairs. Some friends that are younger than us who've loved their au pairs.
Right.
Yeah.
I know we have some neighbors.
Yeah.
That have moved away since, but they've had a couple au pairs.
Yeah, and it's worked out great for them.
And they had a great experience with them.
Yeah, it just depends.
No question.
Right. I guess it just depends how you click and how mature the person is, let's be honest. Yeah, you have to be kind of mature to do this.
I think that's a big thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, one thing that was really discussed a lot, I guess, was this time that Louise spent on the phone with her friend. So.
And wasn't it not only her friend, but her calls back home to England?
Maybe. I'm not quite sure about that. She claimed she only called home once a week. Right. But it wasn't the expense. It was the time spent.
It was the time
when
on the
she
phone.
Was supposed to be with the kids. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess this is the 90s, so they could look at their phone bill. It was the home phone, and they could see how long she was on the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess part of their agreement in their meeting also was that she should limit her calls to 5 minutes, which seems a little strict.
That does.
I would think, you know, you put the kids down for a nap or something, you could talk longer than that.
Sure.
But if she's getting to the point where she's not being responsible, I can also see where they might feel like they need to really lay down the law and say 5 minutes. So I can see both sides of this.
Right.
Yeah. So if she's, you know, out late at night, then she might not get up in the morning. And when she did get up, I guess Sunil was concerned that she just seemed tired. And if you're tired, you're going to be crabby. It's hard to deal with crying kids when you're tired.
Right. You're going
to
be short-tempered.
Yeah.
You know.
You're not going to be involved in doing things with the children.
Right.
So it was on February 4th, just 5 days after the Epins had met with Louise to talk about her work with the kids, that Louise called 911. Because 8-month-old Maddie wasn't breathing right and he wasn't responsive. In Louise's interview with the BBC, she says that Maddie was very sleepy all day on February 4th. She said he slept most of the day, but then she did say that she played with him for a couple of hours in the living room floor and gave him a bath and did feed him an afternoon meal. Now, Louise said she tried to page each of the Epins before she called 911. Which isn't the brightest thing. And we could get to that, but I'm thinking these au pairs should probably have basic emergency training, BLS, you know.
Well, they should.
First aid, CPR.
And there should be, if there's an emergency, a horrible emergency, the first thing you do is call 911.
Right.
And then try to contact the parents.
And the suspicious little girl in me thinks, well, maybe she was worried because she did something and didn't want to call 911, was hoping she could just kind of fix it. You know what I mean? You do something wrong, you want to just kind of patch things up.
Right.
And not make a big deal out of it.
Let's not involve 911, the emergency services, unless I have to.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I do know that daycare centers here in the United States, or at least where we live, you have to have CPR.
Well, yeah.
To work there.
You know, who knows when that horrible accident or tragedy is going to happen?
And kids choke on things all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to know how to deal with that.
Or they're playing outside and they fall and hit their head. I mean, there's all sorts of things.
Right. But I guess Deborah said that she did go over with Louise about giving breaths and basic CPR of an infant.
Well, okay.
Yep.
But then why did she waste time, in a sense, waste time. Why did she try to call the parents? Why didn't she try to call 911 right away?
I don't
away?
Know. She said she was in a panic and she tried to page them but couldn't reach them. So I don't know what that means exactly. Maybe she paged them and they didn't call right back. You know, it could take a while. This was, you know, before everyone had a cell phone.
Well, yeah. I mean, but Mrs. Dr. Epin's an ophthalmologist. So she's in an office, right?
I would guess. I don't know. I mean, some ophthalmologists do surgery.
Maybe she's doing some surgery, but still, you're in an office and the secretary gets a call from your au pair that says, I need to talk to Dr. Epin because her child is really sick. You're going to get her right away.
Sure.
Or if she...
She might have just paged. She might not have made a big deal.
She might have called the hospital or something.
Who knows?
Had him voice paged.
I don't think she let anyone know it was an emergency. But then she got really nervous and called 911, and this was at 3:45 p.m.
See, that gets back to your theory that she had done something, and she was hoping that it would be able to be covered up a little bit.
Right.
So.
I do think that's possible.
She paged him.
That's assuming a lot. I have no idea. But anyway, EMS did come, and they ended up taking him to the hospital. Louise stayed at the house with Maddie's older brother, Brandon, while Maddie was taken to the children's hospital. Sunil and Deborah were notified. I think actually Deborah did call back and finally talk to Louise. EMS might have told her to try again or to say it was an emergency,
right.
But she did connect.
She did finally get through to her.
Yes. And I remember that Deborah said something to her about, well, did you give him the breaths?
Yeah.
So that's what made me think there was a little CPR training going on.
Okay.
Which I would think if you're a doctor, well, even not being a doctor, I would want my babysitter to know what to do in an emergency, of course.
You would, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would. Well, I remember I used to teach a babysitting class for 11 and 12-year-olds, and we taught them how to do what to do if they're choking, you know, how to give breaths. And we also, a big part of it was, well, when do you call 911? When do you call the parents? You know, which kind of events are priority, are more emergent than others, like a triaging of what's going on.
Right. But that was a specific class that you ran.
For babysitting.
For babysitting.
Yeah.
So who knows what this au pair had for any of these classes, or not classes, just information.
She may have had very little to none, yeah.
Because it's different.
What's different?
I mean, you're training people that are babysitting kids.
People younger than she was.
Right.
Yeah.
And the au pair is just looking to match people up with families.
Sure, but I just think basic child care includes what to do in emergency.
Well, it should.
Call me crazy.
It should include
that. It should,
that.
Yeah. And I think that probably some au pair agencies do more than that, I would think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Sunil and Deborah went to meet Maddie at Boston Children's Hospital because they found out what was going on. And Louise stayed at home with the older child.
Right. And now the Epin's worst nightmare is starting.
Sure. So Deborah and Sunil, they arrive at Children's Hospital ER, and they found Maddie, and he was in a coma.
Right. He was intubated.
Yep.
And looked like shit.
Yep. And Deborah, an ophthalmologist, as we said, she examined Maddie's eyes, and she saw right away that he had bleeding in the retina behind the eyes. So she knew that this was a very bad sign for his prognosis. Now, he was suffering a massive brain hemorrhage, and his injuries were thought to be textbook example of shaken impact or shaken baby syndrome. So I know you really want to let us know what you think of this. Go ahead. It's your turn.
Well, okay. I was going to save this till later.
Oh, you were?
But I'll do it now.
Well, this is when he gets to the ER.
Because I think...
Tell me what's going on right now.
I think I would rather talk about this shaken baby abusive head trauma when we get to the trial and the defense is presenting all their things.
Well, can you just give give me a little bit about what you think's going on in the ER here? He's in a coma. He's got a brain bleed.
So he's in a
What's
coma.
What's Deborah Epin thinking when she looks in his eyes?
And he's got a brain bleed and he's got retinal hemorrhages.
Right.
And the first thing you're going to think about is abuse.
So Deborah Epin would have known
actually, I shouldn't say that.
Okay.
The first thing you're going to think about is head trauma. And then the second thing you're going to think about is caused by abuse, because his kid is, 8 months old?
Yes.
So he's not diving off of swings or anything like that. So to have a significant amount of head trauma that Matthew had, the thought is that he had some form of abuse inflicted on him.
Okay. So at 5:30 p.m., surgeons operated on him to relieve pressure that was building inside his skull. What would they be doing?
So they would basically, without sounding too gross, be drilling a hole into his skull and allowing the blood to come out.
Okay. But what about swelling? Does that help with relieving the swelling?
It will help if he's got significant brain swelling, they would maybe take part of the skull off to relieve the swelling. They'd also be treating the swelling medically with medications that can help reduce the swelling.
Okay. All right, so at the same time, the Newton Police Department began their investigation into this. Sergeant Bill Byrne spoke with Maddie's doctors to see what was going on. So obviously the doctors called the police, so they thought this was abuse. The police aren't normally going to come for a sick kid.
No.
Okay.
And I'll talk about it later, but this is a clear-cut case of abuse.
So the doctors told Sergeant Bill Byrne that Maddie had probably sustained his injuries just a few hours earlier, so that's important to remember. And at 7 p.m., Sergeant Byrne and three other officers arrived at the Eppen house, and they interviewed Louise Woodward. So she didn't ask for a lawyer, and they read her rights, and they interviewed her. And it wasn't recorded.
No.
No.
And, you know, she didn't ask for a lawyer, and she's 18, like you said. Why would she ask for a lawyer? She doesn't know. She's going to be questioned by the police.
Yeah.
I don't know if they said you can have a lawyer.
Well, that's part of the rights.
Is that the Miranda rights?
Yeah. You have the rights to an attorney. If you can't afford one, one will be appointed to you, that. Yeah.
Maybe we should cut all that out.
No. So.
So she agreed to talk to the police.
Yes. So she told Sergeant Byrne that she'd been alone with the two boys all day. And Matthew, she said, had been irritable since the morning. Now, according to Byrne, Louise told him that she'd become frustrated and irritated that Matthew was crying and fussy. And his report, Sergeant Byrne's report, said that Louise admitted that she had tossed Maddie on the bed. And she also admitted she'd been a little rough with him when she gave him his bath, and she may have dropped him on the bathroom floor. Now, may have, I think you'd know if you dropped a child on the bathroom floor.
Yeah, I mean, that raises all sorts of red flags.
Right. And this will come down to the police officer's word against her, although there were, what, three of them?
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know,
four of them, actually.
The defense will say that they all agreed on the same story.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, and that's a possibility.
But admitting that you were a little rough with the child and admitting that you may have dropped him on the floor, I don't see how you don't know that you drop a kid on the floor.
Right. But I think at this point, she doesn't know quite how bad it is.
Right.
Right? She doesn't. She's
so she's speaking in hypotheticals.
Sure. So she later denied saying that.
Right. Of course she would.
Now, she claimed that about 3:15 p.m., and remember she called 911 about 3:45. So at 3:15 p.m., she said she checked on Matthew in his crib, and she found him breathing in gasps and turning blue. So she said she placed Matthew on the floor and started CPR, but he was still having trouble breathing. So Matthew's injury was so severe that it suggested he'd been abused, shaken, and also slammed against a hard surface.
Right, and that gets back to, well, he had been fussier than normal.
Yeah.
And she might have treated him roughly, and she might have dropped him on the floor. So that explains both those occurrences.
And we'll talk more about it later, but there's also the idea that she was angry about the meeting a few days before, that she'd been given this curfew, that she'd been told she could only be on the phone for 5 minutes, so she might have been angry.
Well, yeah, she could have been.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd prefer not to think about that, because I'm looking for the good in people.
Yeah.
But I don't like the fact that she might have had a grudge against the family and took it out on one of the kids.
And maybe not consciously, but if you've got anger and resentment inside you,
yeah, maybe
and
not
you have a fussy baby, sure. Yeah. Anyway, doctors also noted, interestingly enough, that Matthew had a wrist fracture that was 4 to 6 weeks old. Now, Louise had been working for them for 3 months, so it was still in the time frame where she was the caretaker.
Right.
And the next day, Detective Byrne returned to the hospital to interview Matthew's doctors. And that's when one physician told him that the situation was indeed very grim. The evidence and his interview with Louise indicated that she was responsible for Matthew's injuries as well. Now, the interview that I watched with Detective Byrne, what he said was that he really didn't want to think that Louise would have abused the baby. He said, here's this nice young girl. He said, I wanted more than anyone to think that she didn't do this. But the doctors were quite adamant that it was abuse and that it had happened that day.
Right.
Right.
And she was the only one with him that day.
Yes. Now, at 9 p.m. on February 5th, Louise was arrested for assault and battery to a child, and she was held in the Framingham Women's Prison. The next day, she was arraigned in Newton District Court. She pled not guilty, insisting that she had done nothing to hurt Matthew, and her bail was set at $100,000. So a few days later, on February 9th, Sunil and Deborah made the heart-wrenching, is all I can think to say, decision to take Matthew off of his life support. So he's essentially brain dead.
Well, he'd been brain dead virtually from the time he went into the hospital.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they went a few more days. There wasn't any chance of recovery. He wasn't doing anything.
Yeah.
So.
And we'll talk about later, if he had survived, it could have been some really bad morbidity.
No question. But
he wouldn't have been a normal boy if he had survived.
Yeah, but he wasn't going to survive.
Yeah.
He couldn't breathe on his own.
Yeah.
He couldn't do anything, so.
That's not even an issue then, okay.
It's not. But yes, he would have, if he had somehow survived, he would have been extremely brain damaged.
Yeah. Which we'll talk about, because I do want to talk about that, about things we've seen with other children that did survive these kinds of injuries. So the family gathered in Matthew's hospital room to say goodbye. And Sunil, am I saying that right, Sunil?
Yes.
Okay. They called him Sunny. Held his son in his arms, and he died about a half an hour after the life support was removed.
So what they did was they stopped breathing for him.
Yeah.
And just let nature take its course, because he wasn't breathing on his own. So he stopped breathing, and then his heart stopped, and he died.
Yeah, that's really heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And that's such a shock. That was, what, one day he's a normal little baby, 5 days later, they're going through this.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, Louise Woodward's family and friends back in England were really shocked by all that was going on, because, of course, this was already big news. And nearly $1 million would be donated from people who claimed to know that Louise was innocent. So this knowing, I just have to say, that seems really unreasonable to me. No one else was in the house with Louise and the children that day. No one except Louise can ever know exactly what happened.
Yeah, but all these people know from what a great kid she was growing up that she couldn't have done it.
But everything I've read about Shaken Baby, most of the people who do this could never conceive of doing this until it happens.
Right. And they do it and they say, how could I have done this?
Right, right.
This is an innocent little infant. How could I do this stuff to the child?
Sure. So a jury listened to several weeks of testimony, and they did return with a guilty verdict.
Right, but the verdict was for second-degree manslaughter.
Correct? Murder.
Or murder.
Yep.
Manslaughter wasn't on the table because the defense asked the judge.
We'll get to that.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll shut up.
I just want to say, how crazy is it to think that you can tell who will or will not commit a certain crime? To me, it's just a blind opinion based on no facts.
Right.
You can say, this was a wonderful person, I'm shocked, I can't believe it, but you certainly can't say, I know she didn't do it.
No, you can't. I mean, you read that all the time.
Yeah.
About killers and the neighbors or the family says, he was such a great kid or she was such a great kid, I can't believe he or she did it.
Right, right.
But they did.
So it was February 13th when Louise was arraigned for Matthew's murder, and she pled not guilty. And then Matthew's funeral service was held on that same day, February 13th. On March 5th, a grand jury decided that Louise would face a charge of first-degree murder. And her father, Gary, spoke to the media, and he expressed complete shock and disbelief, and of course he said there's no way she did this. So investigators soon learned that things hadn't been going very well with Louise at the Eapins' home. The Eapins' home in Newton was just a short train ride to Boston, so Louise had many opportunities to enjoy the nightlife of Boston. She often returned home late at night, and she was tired in the mornings. Now, Deborah had told her mother that Louise had become more of a burden than a help because it was like having a teenager to take care of in addition to these two little boys.
Yeah, right. You had mentioned that before.
Yeah, yeah.
So she had three kids instead of two.
Sure. And, you know, she has a busy husband, too. So this woman's taking on, she's got a rough thing here, a rough life here going on.
Yes, she does.
Maybe not rough, but a busy, demanding life. Might be a happy life, but a lot to deal with between the career and the children and the au pair and all that stuff.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. So Louise's trial began on October 7th, and her defense brought in doctors to dispute the testimony of Matthew's doctors. The prosecutor claimed that Louise killed Matthew in a frustrated, unhappy fit of rage, but the defense argued that Matthew's head injury may have happened 4 to 6 weeks ago when the wrist fracture had happened. So pathologist Gerard Fain, who did his autopsy, said that he found no evidence that Matthew had been shaken.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that.
But, I mean, my thought is you can always find an expert to give your side.
Well,
that's the way the world works.
I'm going to be charitable and not comment on that just yet.
Okay.
So the Epins underwent intense public scrutiny.
They sure did, yeah.
They were typecast as yuppies more interested in their careers than in raising their children. Deborah in particular was demonized for working instead of staying home with her children.
And
little,
I just think,
little mother bias there, right?
I just think that's bullshit. She went through med school and had student loans. You don't go through med school and then stay home with your kids. It just, you can't.
No. And like you said, she made accommodations. She wasn't working full time.
Yeah, right.
So she was working and being an at-home mom.
And I think it's, you know, it's kind of sounds like a nice choice to have an au pair because you're keeping your kids at home, trying to give them more of, you know, not having to go to daycare every morning, letting them stay home with someone. So I really think that people were hard on her for no good reason.
Well, absolutely. So the defense decided to let Louise take the stand, which is interesting because
we all know
you never do that stuff,
right? You never
do
that, no.
Louise described in detail what had happened on the day that Matthew went to the hospital. She said she acted quickly when she found Matthew unresponsive and gasping in the crib. While being questioned by her attorneys, Louise cracked a smile at an inappropriate time.
So she sure did.
They're talking about this horrible tragedy and she's smiling.
Yeah, I think it was her attorney who was asking her, did you shake him? Did you harm him?
Yeah.
And she giggled and smiled.
Right.
Which...
And then her attorneys believe that turned the jurors off.
It turned me off watching it, I have to admit.
Yeah. Well, and the interview on the BBC turned me off. I mean...
Really?
To me, it was way inappropriate, but that's another topic.
Okay.
Her occasional smiling and laughing could have been because she was awkward, but the jurors said, no, that didn't make any difference. And she did deny that she ever said she was rough with Maddie.
Right.
So this is, again, the he said, she said.
Well, here's where she said that she had told the detective that she popped Maddie on the bed.
Right.
Claiming that that was an English expression.
English idiom.
Instead of saying she threw him, she popped him.
Yeah.
Like she just sat him down.
Right.
I think.
But what about,
yeah,
I may have dropped him on the floor.
Well, she denied that, too, in court.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Detective Byrne said that he was really quite offended to see her say that on the stand because, according to him, she did say these things. And she was just bold-faced lying on the stand.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the defense decided to take a major gamble in this case. To prevent the jury from compromising, they asked them to find Louise guilty of second-degree or first-degree murder, not the lesser charge of manslaughter, or to find her not guilty and let her go. So the manslaughter charge was excluded.
Right. They took that off the table.
They did. And so that gave the jurors no middle ground. They could either say she murdered him or she was not guilty.
Right.
Right. So they deliberated for a full 3 days. And on October 30th, the jury found Louise guilty of second-degree murder. Louise broke into tears, and she hollered out, why didn't they believe me? Why are you doing this to me? To me, it made her look a little entitled, I'm going to be honest. But I'm going to be objective here. She's an 18-year-old girl. I'm sure she was shocked that her life was pretty much over.
Certainly.
Yeah. And in a pub in Louise's hometown of Elton, her supporters watched as the verdict was read, and let's just say they weren't happy.
No, they were deeply distraught.
Yes. So the jury didn't believe the defense's claim that Matthew's injury could have been sustained weeks before he was admitted to the hospital. On October 31st, Judge Hiller Zobel sentenced Louise to life in prison with no parole for at least 15 years. So at this point, I'm going to pause and see if you'd like to talk a little bit about Shaken Baby and what went on in the courtroom.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, here's my soapbox, because there was a lot of controversy.
And, well, yeah, there has been over the past, 20 years, too.
And there's continued to be controversy, not just in the Woodward case, but in other cases.
Yes.
And people are starting to deny Shaken Baby syndrome, that it even exists.
Some people. I don't think it's a large amount of people, but yeah.
But, and that's what Louise's defense attorneys seized on.
They did, yeah.
So I'm going to just read you a statement by the American Academy of Pediatrics concerning Shaken Baby Syndrome, which is now called abusive head trauma.
Okay.
Okay. So, the existence of abusive head trauma in infants and young children is a settled scientific fact. All right?
Okay. Yes.
The scientific report support for the diagnosis of abusive head trauma comes from over 40 years of research in a broad array of clinical and basic science disciplines, including pediatrics, neurosciences, ophthalmology, orthopedics, radiology, pathology, epidemiology, and biomechanics. In a report issued in April 2012, the Centers for Disease Control reported that serious traumatic brain injury in young children is largely the result of abuse.
So this is something you feel passionately about, because you're tearing up with this.
This is me off.
Okay.
All right. So, in some cases of abusive head trauma, the adult who is caring for the child admits to harming his or her infant. Published accounts of confessions document that some parents have shaken their children on repeated occasions, leading to the injuries that physicians identify in these cases. So these reports confirm the published clinical findings. And the last thing I'll say, and then I'll shut up. As always in medicine, knowledge about abusive head trauma advances with research. Although there is still much to learn about the mechanisms and precise pathophysiology of injury and death in abusive head trauma, the position that shaking cannot harm an infant, which is held by only a few vocal advocates, has not been scientifically supported by clinical research or practice.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the court case more, and then I'm going to come back to you to tell us the physiology. I'm going to let you rest for a minute. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So
it just got me going.
I know it did. That's good that you're passionate. I like that. So on November 4th, the judge heard a plea from the defense for the murder verdict to be overturned or for the charge to be reduced to manslaughter. And the judge agreed to consider this plea.
Now, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I'm a layperson. I don't know law.
Right.
But the defense asked for manslaughter to be taken off the consideration.
They did.
And now they want it back in.
Well, they do. They don't want her to.
I don't see how you can have it both ways.
Well, they don't think that she should be punished for their decision to remove it from the table.
Okay.
There was a lot of sympathy for her. Yeah. Anyway, the judge decided that he would consider it. And on November 10th, the judge did reduce her charge to manslaughter. And that wasn't too shocking, but the shocking thing was that he let her go with time served. So that was 279 days, and she was free.
Less than a year.
Yep.
And you can get up to 10 years for manslaughter.
Yes.
So
not only did he reduce the charge, he let her go.
Yeah, that's the shocking thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see, because I would agree that manslaughter is a more appropriate sentence than second-degree murder.
Well, all right.
Now I can do that.
Okay.
But to let her go after less than a year served?
Yeah.
Ah.
That doesn't seem right. So there was a hearing on December 3rd where the Supreme Court Justice Ruth Abrams rejected a prosecution bid to have Louise return to prison. So the prosecution was not happy about this.
Nobody was.
The Epins were heartbroken. Louise's defense team had an appeal hearing because not only did she want the sentence to be reduced, now that happened, she wants to be exonerated. So they had this appeal hearing in March of 1998, claiming that the defense was denied vital medical evidence concerning Matthew's skull fracture. They told the court that the defense now had conclusive evidence that the baby had not been murdered. Defense medical witnesses would have demonstrated their evidence in court if they'd been allowed to see the skull fracture, they said. So, opening the appeal case for the prosecution, Assistant DA Sabita Singh said the defense had been given ample time to ask for the skull evidence, and her manslaughter conviction was upheld. So after this appeal was concluded, Louise was allowed to return to the United Kingdom. And on returning home, Louise gave a press conference, which was broadcast live in the UK and in Boston. She gave an interview, and this is the interview we were talking about that we watched, for which she was not paid, to Martin Bashir on the BBC program Panorama. Now, in this interview, she maintained that she did nothing to hurt Matthew and that it was absolutely a miscarriage of justice that she had this manslaughter conviction. Now, Matthew's parents filed a civil suit to prevent Louise from earning any profits from the selling of her story. So she's forbidden by an out-of-court settlement from making any money for herself by selling interviews, book, or movie rights. Now, Louise was interviewed by Mike Wallace for 60 Minutes, as were two doctors who claimed the science of shaken baby syndrome was flawed. And this episode drew a lot of criticism, as it seemed to point blame at Sunil and Deborah Epen. And it's been pulled from the internet, so I think that there was a retraction.
There must have been.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what I read before, I mean, it's a scientific fact.
Yeah.
And people that are going to testify to the contrary are just whores that are looking for money, or fame, or both.
That's your opinion.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Do you want to just tell us basically, you know, what happens if you shake a baby? What happened in his brain?
Well, in really simple terms, look at the brain as being something inside a box. And when you shake the baby back and forth, the brain is moving in this box. So you shake it and it hits the back of the box. And you shake it more and it hits the front of the box. And you do that and you're going to get bleeding in areas of the brain. And if you shake them side to side, I mean, the same thing. The brain is enclosed in a box and it's a little movable. And things can happen to it with the shaken syndrome.
Okay. And a baby's head is heavy. What's the
right.
What's the proportion, basically, on an 8-month-old of their head to body compared to an adult?
Well, it's probably in an 8-month-old, 20 to 25% of their body mass.
Is
and
their head?
And they don't have the greatest neck control, so it's more movable.
Right, right. Okay. So you get this bleeding in there.
Yes.
And then what? Well, why do parts of the brain die?
Well, here's what'll happen. Depending on the significance of the bleed, if it's a massive bleed, what will happen is that the brain gets pushed down and herniates through the lower part of the skull called the foramen magnum.
This is what happened with the salt poisoning in the Lacey Spears case for Garnet.
Right.
Similar thing.
This probably is part of what happened to Matthew Epen, although he had more generalized brain swelling. But so you herniate the brain, and when you do that in the brain stem that herniates through the bottom part of the skull, that controls heart rate, respiratory rate, and everything.
Okay.
So that shuts down.
What about that bleeding behind the eyes? What does that mean?
Well, that just means there was trauma.
Okay. And you can just see it when you examine the eyes?
Yes. That's you can look at the retina and see blood in the retinal field. Now, if it's not as significant a bleed, the defects would depend on where the bleed was. So you can have motor defects where your part of your body doesn't work well. You can have speech defects. You can have defects in behavior. It all depends on what part of the brain is damaged by the bleed.
Okay.
Because when you have a bleed, you're killing brain cells.
So what do they mean by the triad of symptoms?
In this kid?
Well, in Shaken Baby, they say there's a triad.
Well, there's new stuff that's more than a triad.
Oh, okay.
So in the triad was retinal hemorrhages, cerebral bleed, and coma. Anyway, they've looked at a study in 2015, which was looked at as a prediction tool for abusive head trauma. So they're estimating the probability of abusive head trauma in children presenting with intracranial injuries. And they're looking at specific combinations of six features.
Okay.
Which include bruising of the head or neck, seizures, apnea, which means you're not breathing, rib fractures, long bone fractures, and hemorrhages in the retina. So if you have three or more of these occurring, you're probably abused.
And Matthew Eapen, also had a skull fracture on the back of his head.
Okay.
That's why they thought that he actually was thrown against a hard surface.
He had a skull fracture. He had a long bone fracture in his arm. He was certainly apneic because he wasn't breathing. He had retinal hemorrhages, so he had at least four of the six.
But the arm fracture was old.
Right. But
and that's how they proposed. Well, that's why they proposed that maybe the head injury was old as well. And was like a ticking time bomb that went off. So maybe someone had injured him weeks ago, which means it could have been anyone. Could have been the parents. Could have been the grandparents, maybe.
Well, I think that's just wistful thinking on the defense's part.
Why? But that's possible, isn't it?
Possible, but not probable. I mean, the fracture was while he was under the care of Louise.
That's what the prosecution said, and that's what the physician
said. She was working for the family. Maybe I shouldn't say under the care of, but she was working there. So I think that it could have been a remote occurrence, and then the more acute trauma inflicted on him at the time of his demise.
So you think the wrist fracture shows maybe there was a pattern of her being rough with the child?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it all comes down to looking at the whole picture and saying, well, we have this and this and this and this.
Right.
And this is more indicative of traumatic brain injury.
Now, the Eapens had said that their biggest fear was that Louise Woodward would become a millionaire because she killed their baby. And in the 60 Minutes interview, Louise hinted that if Matthew's injuries were not from his older brother, then the parents should be questioned more closely about this. Now, Louise Woodward went on to study law at London South Bank University, and she claimed that her experiences with the United States justice system led her to have this interest in studying the law.
Yeah, is she an attorney?
No, I think she's actually a salsa teacher.
Okay, that's a far cry from being an attorney.
Yeah, but I think...
I'm not knocking salsa teachers.
No.
But if she went to college to study law and she ends up being a dance instructor.
Well, she decided she likes that better.
Okay.
Don't make judgments on that.
I'm sorry.
Okay. So one interesting thing I recently learned was that before her trial, Louise did voluntarily decide to undergo a polygraph exam. This was done with a polygraph examiner hired by her own legal team. Now, she was asked questions about whether she caused the injury to Matthew while he was in her care on February the 4th, 1997. She denied having caused any injuries to him. Her answers were reported to be truthful to a confidence level of 95%.
So says the defense.
Yes. So the validity of the polygraph test was questioned, and based on research conducted by Congress's Independent Office of Technological Advancement, it was inadmissible in court, which has been the history with polygraphs.
Well, that's the history of polygraphs.
Yep. Now, Sunil and Deborah established the Maddie Eapen Foundation in Matthew's memory to improve the safety and welfare of children by educating the public about the dangers of shaking a child. Now, also, we watched this video, Forever Shaken, that I wanted to talk about a little bit because it had a profound effect on me. It was a 2014 30-minute documentary.
It was a chilling documentary, just looking at what can happen to infants that are shaken.
It was produced, actually, by the parents of a child who was the victim of shaken baby syndrome. And what this documentary does is it looks at the long-term impact of children who suffer from abusive head trauma or shaken baby syndrome. And in it, national child abuse experts also provide some strategies for the prevention of shaken baby. So Tiffany and Brandon Verzel, the parents who produced this documentary, they have a daughter named Alexis. And Alexis was injured by her daycare provider back in 2008. So 1 hour after Tiffany left Alexis at daycare, she got a phone call that Alexis was unconscious and that the ambulance had been called. Brandon and Tiffany arrived at the ER before the ambulance, and when Alexis had a CT scan, they found out she had bleeding on her brain, and then she was life-flighted to a trauma center. So according to Tiffany, she and her husband were questioned by police and by the trauma center's social worker. And later, doctors told them that Alexis had a subdural hematoma, and she was likely a victim of shaking and an impact to her head. So what I learned also is it's not that unusual to have the shaking and the impact as a combination in abusive infants.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it took 85 days after the injury for the daycare provider to be arrested, and she was charged with knowingly causing serious bodily injury to a child. But the daycare provider was found not guilty. The jury would later say that they got hung up on whether or not the provider knew that she would cause serious bodily harm when she shook and threw Alexis on the floor.
That's kind of splitting hairs, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, maybe not the shaking.
But if that's the charge, knowingly causing...
But if you throw the baby on the floor?
I think it's common sense that
aren't you going to figure that could damage the baby?
I would think so.
Another vote for our justice system.
Yeah. So the sad part is that Alexis was left a triplegic, which means that 3 of her 4 limbs are paralyzed.
Right.
And the video actually showed several children that were left paralyzed, had motor disabilities, speech and learning difficulties. So it was really heartbreaking because here we're looking at the kids later on.
Right. And there was one kid who was having seizures and looked almost vegetative. I mean, he was unresponsive.
His own father was the one that did it too. But I just thought that was really quite a video. I was impressed by this couple.
It was.
Yeah. So a little bit about prevention. I just feel like I would be remiss if I didn't at least say this, since we've been talking about it.
No, I think that's your job.
Okay.
I think you got to talk about this.
Okay.
I mean, even though it can be an impulsive act, but just recognizing when you might be approaching that danger zone would be a big help. So.
Okay.
Go for it.
Well, part of prevention is reporting any signs of abuse, because what they talked about was that a lot of these kids, before there had been signs that maybe they were abused, they'd had like bruises before that were unexplained, or their daycare provider had been, someone had thought that the daycare provider had abused a different child, but that was never reported. So maybe if they reported these other incidents, we could prevent these major incidents.
Possibly.
So that's one thing.
You know, you don't ever want to accuse somebody falsely.
Right.
But if you have a kind of a gut feeling, I think you ought to.
Yeah. Well, that's what they're saying. You don't have to know for sure. If you suspect, you need to report.
Right.
And also, so if you're taking care of a baby, have a plan each day. Have an escape hatch. So if you're home taking care of babies, or if you work in a daycare, what if you're losing it? What if you can't stand it? You know, what if it's bothering you? You need to have a way out where you can just walk away.
Right. Because remember, crying doesn't hurt the baby.
Right.
Right?
It's much better to put them down and just let them cry and walk away.
Let them cry.
Yep. So that was another thing they said. No baby has died from crying too much.
Absolutely.
So, and I think a lot of people have trouble with that. A lot of people think they need to soothe and comfort the child.
Well, yeah. I mean, your instinct is I need to get this baby quiet.
But that's not true.
Calm the baby down. No, it's not.
Sometimes they just need to cry.
And if it raises your anxiety level or your stress level, you're better off letting them cry. Put them down, walk away, let them cry.
Right. And also, call someone to talk if you feel like you're in that position.
Okay. I mean, that's, I can't exactly picture somebody who's stressed to the limit and saying, whoops, I'm going to take a time out and call my friend to make sure I don't hurt this kid. But yeah, I mean, that's good advice.
Yeah.
Just, I don't think it's very realistic.
Well, I think, you know, when you get really close to the point of losing it, yeah, it's too late.
Yeah.
But maybe if you're having a rough day, it's a good idea to call your mother-in-law or something and say, I'm going to drop Johnny off for a couple hours and
yeah.
take a break.
No, I think that's well spoken. Good.
Yeah. Okay. So another thing about Louise is that she did have a baby 16 years after this incident. So 2014.
So 34 or so.
Yep.
Mid-30s.
Yep. Well, she said she's done nothing wrong and she doesn't see why it's a big deal. And some reporters did approach Matthew's mom, Debbie Epen, and she said that she really didn't want to make a comment about it.
Well, good for her. What could she say?
Right. What would she say? It's really no point in saying anything. No. But I think it was really a good idea to have this foundation in his memory.
Definitely.
And I really like the fact that no one is allowed to make money off of this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's important. Did you have anything else you wanted to say about shaken baby syndrome?
No. I've probably made enough enemies from defense attorneys and some physicians, so I'm going to leave it.
But you think that shaken baby is absolutely a thing?
There is absolutely no question. It's a real thing.
Okay.
And anybody who suggests otherwise is totally misinformed.
Okay.
Okay, how's that?
That's clear and concise.
That's positive enough, right?
Yep, that's good. So I just want to talk about a couple other things. I wanted to announce that we have special plans for the holidays.
Oh, we do.
Yes.
Whoopee.
So beginning on December 14th, we'll begin our 12 Beers of Christmas series. And what these are is they're 10 to 20 minute podcasts that we're going to release each day from December 14th to December 24th, where Dick's going to review a holiday themed beer. And we're going to briefly cover a Christmas time crime. So we're going to do that every night. And then on Christmas Day, just to polish it all off, we're going to release our recap discussion of our favorite Christmas film, Love Actually.
The all-time favorite.
So what we're going to do is watch it and talk about it. And it's not about crime, so.
No, it's not.
But it's still going to be fun and we're going to do it.
I'm looking forward to that. My favorite movie.
Yeah.
Even though it got crappy reviews, by and large.
Yeah.
It's just.
It's a classic.
It is. It's a Christmas movie.
It is. And it's very romantic.
Yes.
Yes. It's a romantic Christmas movie.
I'm looking forward to it.
So we've got the 12 Beers of Christmas, December 14th to December 24th will be 11 beers and.
Yes, the final beer.
11 stories. Then the final beer.
Final beer is with Love Actually.
Is with Love Actually instead of a crime.
Right.
Because we don't want to talk about a crime on Christmas Day. We want to talk about love. Actually.
Actually.
Yeah. So we will still have our regular True Crime Brewery episodes on December the 13th and December the 27th. So we're only going to skip one of those. So we're going to be busy, Dickie.
No kidding.
Yeah.
We're already busy.
Yeah. So we're going to have those two episodes as well. So if you are just a hardcore, full, in-depth, true crime person, it's okay. Don't worry. We've got you covered.
Right. We'll still do your stuff.
Yeah. And don't forget, our beer review contest is still running until January 1st. And the winner now is going to get a TCB t-shirt, a coaster, and yes, I threw in a snifter.
Whoa.
So don't be shy. Call those in. You go to the voicemail link on our website. Just click the tab and give a beer review. And then we'll get it and we'll listen to it. And if you win, we'll play it on our on a future episode.
And you'll get these
2017.
Great prizes.
Yeah, three prizes.
Three.
Yes.
Look again. Three.
Yep. So is there anything else? Did I cover everything?
I think we covered everything.
Okay. So we will be back Well, we have another full episode the day before the 12 Beers of Christmas start.
Right, we got one next week.
We'll be back on about the 13th or so with our next full episode. And then the day after that, you can start listening to the 12 Beers of Christmas.
Right.
Every night.
What a great thing to do.
It will be.
Over the Christmas holidays.
Yep.
The 12 Beers of Christmas.
Yep.
And so, 12 Crimes of Christmas.
Christmas Crimes.
Right.
Yes. So, also, I'd like to thank everyone who's given us 5-star reviews. And if you haven't, what the fuck?
Whoa.
Get on it.
Chilly.
Now, I know not everyone's on iTunes and you can't do it, and that's cool. But a large majority of our listeners are on iTunes. And I would just ask you, please, give us a 5-star review if you think we deserve it. I know it can be a little bit of an effort to do a 5-star review on iTunes. They make you go through some steps, but it really would mean a lot to us because it's the 5-star reviews that increase our listening audience and get us to venture out and get more listeners.
Yeah, so get out there and give those 5-star reviews. Come on.
And then also follow us on Instagram and on Twitter at TigerEverPods and give us a like on Facebook because that would be really cool too.
See?
Yep.
It's easy.
Yep. So until the next time at the Quiet End, take care.
Have fun.
Bye-bye.